Okay, before we let you go, we keep it real on this podcast. So okay. I have like two quick ones for you because we haven't talked about this.
Okay.
But when I went to be like, oh, I'll hit up Hollinger, and then I was like, oh, he unfollowed me. What was the, I'm not great on Twitter, but what do you think was your breaking point with me where you were like, you know what? Fuck this guy. Like, was it a Grizzlies observation? We know it wasn't anything political because I don't know that I touch on any of that stuff. Hey, we get it. You like the SEC. I don't think I'm not anti-UVA, so I don't know that it was that. I just, for the staff here, we want to know. I was like, oh, okay. And I don't want, and don't follow me now because I brought it up because I'll block you. All right. I'm not looking for the follow. Do you remember when it was like, all right, enough of this fucking Russillo guy?
I think I was working for the Grizzlies and was streamlining some of the media people out of my accounts.
Yeah, all right, maybe. That's John Hollinger, who at a time works in the front office of the Memphis Grizzlies. We'll get to that. But on this playoff season, his Gobert MVP vote and breaking down some of the other series, and also esoteric of Czarface, his career, and specifically working with the late great MF Doom, and life advice. It's the Ryan Russillo podcast presented by FanDuel. Take a shot at betting the NBA with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting the Explore page and the Pulse and bet live same-game parlays for every NBA game. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, official partner of the NBA. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available. And listen to the end of the episode for additional details. Must be 21 and older and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's Rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or Arby's.com. Okay, before we talk to Hollinger, some hoop stuff there, his time in the front office and member Czarface, esoteric. There's a couple quick little things that I want to do because I could do a bigger open on this if I wanted to, and I would title the podcast. I could do like 30 minutes solo on this if I really wanted to and come up with like 10 of them, or I could go deep on just a few, but I'm going to keep it shorter here and have Saruti join me for a bit of it. And that is just irresponsible potential storylines after just a couple games of the first round of the playoffs, right? Because we've already seen coming off of game one in that first weekend, what I was trying to do with Bill the whole time, remind yourself, game one, it's game one. It's all we have to look at. There's going to be different stories in game two. Utah still has a Ja Morant problem, and Ja is just another level. And considering where you'd be at with him in the regular season, if you wanted to argue against him, you could say, okay, yeah, but you know, is he really make other people better? Does he play enough defense? You know, is he a little bit too much about himself? He can't really shoot, can't really stretch the floor. You know, you looked at how Golden State played him in the last regular season game, and then it's like, wait a minute, now should I take this guy over Zion? Because that's actually happening right now. I want to ask Hollinger about it because he was still sort of with Memphis when they were using that number two pick, but he wasn't, which is, you know, he'll explain it. But Saruti, I do think the Ja Zion, because we just had, I mean, Ja do what he did against Utah here. And you can say, hey, it's the number one seed, but they didn't have Mitchell and they missed Mitchell again for parts of game two, whatever. The Jazz figured out a way to do this. We're talking about 73 points his first two games. I'm not there yet, but there is nothing like the playoff glow up for the young generation of NBA players, the same way we had with Doncic last year and Ja now. There was never a conversation about Ja over Zion, considering what Zion was. Now it's happening after these two games. And beyond that, it becomes, well, how is Ja not a top five point guard? Because that's what happens too, is you'll have guys say, that guy's not top five. Like, that's crazy. And everybody gets super pissed about it. And then you're like, all right, put together your list of five and tell me where Ja is. Because I think most people accepted he was closer to 10 than he ever would have been five. But again, after his performances, game one and two, doing whatever he wants, I mean, they just can't stop him. I mean, they can come up with schemes, and unless you want to build a Giannis wall and keep everybody else open, he's just impossible right now.
Yeah, I remember like around the draft, there were a few people that were saying, hey, you know, Ja over Zion. I see the fit in the NBA. Like, what is Zion going to be in the NBA? And I was kind of, I don't want to say I was one of those people, but I was entertaining the idea of, okay, I can see what Ja is going to be in the NBA. I didn't know if I could necessarily project what Zion would be. Now, Zion lit it up this year. He had all of his stats in the regular season, basically, other than like assists. I mean, all the advanced metrics, like they all go to Zion. He's been the better player. But I think there are, maybe are a couple arguments for Ja and that, okay, he's doing it in big games. He beat Steph head to head. He won two straight play-in games to get into the playoffs. I think you could argue that is the Grizzlies roster that much better than the Pelicans, you know, and Ja is the best player on the team and he led them to the playoffs in the same conference, right? And this is also a league that kind of seems to favor guards and wings and that type of player. So I think you could, I understand the argument of saying, hey, I think I would take Ja for 5-10 years over Zion. I wouldn't, but I can see how you would get yourself to get to that point.
My problem, my only pushback from it, and you're right, like Memphis isn't worlds better than New Orleans talent-wise, but Memphis knows everybody's role. Like they know exactly who they're supposed to be, what they're supposed to do, and if Valanciunas has foul trouble, then they have a fix for it. I love Desmond Bane. I love that guy. I love his comfort level, and he kind of figures out exactly which hole to fill depending on the group that's out there with him. Because, I mean, at some point, he was just straight-up spot shooter for him and felt like he hit everything. But I'm telling you, in college, he can do more. And the more he's trusted with in the NBA, like Bane is – I don't want to get too crazy with it because you could also say if I'm another team, I'm calling about Bane. Well, guess what? They're not trading him to you because he's super cheap on this rookie deal to back into the first round. But I love what he does. But Memphis knows their identity. Everybody knows their roles. New Orleans clearly doesn't. But if the conversation for the entire season was how high is Zion as a player, not just Zion versus Ja, like is Zion bordering a top 10 player? Should he be all NBA third team? And then two playoff games later, we're going, no, Ja's the guy. That's where I'm like, okay, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that you can go for 5 to 6 months with an accepted ranking of players and then it all changes because of two playoff games. But again, if you're sitting there arguing that Zion's at home, I can't say anything back to you.
I think the reason that I ultimately would not say I would take Ja over Zion, I would stick with Zion, is because Zion has that weird thing where it's like he could be a generational guy. Like he could be something we've literally never seen before in the league. I know what Ja is. Like there are guys like Ja, like maybe not an exact carbon copy of him, but like, yeah, all right, Ja's a great player, but it's easy to project that. I think I would still take Zion's upside and what he could potentially be as like this Draymond Green, LeBron, Sean Kemp hybrid. And I would just say if it ends up not working out in 5 to 10 years, then I'd be okay with that because I took a chance on his unbelievably raw talent.
All right. And honestly, what if De'Aaron Fox had 60 points in his first two playoff games and they were 1-1?
There are so many point guards that we wanted to do this with. And I'm not saying that Ja has probably done more than a lot of those guys that we talked about. De'Aaron's one of those guys. Like, oh, De'Aaron, is he creeping into the top five? The top five point guard thing seems to change like every 2 weeks. It's unbelievable. That position more than any other one is totally volatile. And, you know, if Ja has like if they get bounced in a couple games here, he has a slow start to next year, then we'll completely forget about him. And it's not going to be fair. But I just think the point guard position in general, we change that list so often, I don't even know what to make of it.
The two others that I would have done, speaking of point guards, and, you know, I caught a bunch of shit, I think, when I brought up the Booker part of, like, you know, I don't know what his long-term Phoenix thing is. And for anybody that, you know, look, you want to give me a hard time about it, it got aggregated a certain way. But, I mean, everybody in NBA circles that knows what's going on has talked about this potential, you know, Knicks landing spot for a handful of guys. Whether if Karl Anthony Towns ever gets upset, what he wanted ask out. You know, you can't ever say no to any of this stuff anymore, by the way. All right. Kawhi taught us one thing, and that is never assume anything with a player or the team's best player. Because the Knicks have staffed guys with connections to Utah, and they've staffed obviously another coach who has connection to the Kentucky guys. So it was always like, well, if Booker ever got upset, you know, don't ignore what the Knicks are doing over there. If Karl Anthony Towns ever got upset, you know, Donovan's guy, you know, he's with him in Utah. He's over. Like, that was the whole point. So the reason I bring up irresponsible potential storylines would be if Chris Paul's way more hurt than he seems to think he is, and he didn't look very good, would that change the Booker part of it? Because Paul loves it there. Booker's happy as hell. Booker having Chris Paul is a completely different situation than missing out on the playoffs again and thinking, okay, you know, where am I going to be at now long term with this team? To ignore that as a potential possibility is foolish. So I certainly would never do that with any of those guys, but I get worried about it. Like, how much could the Paul conversation change if now, instead of the 1 year player option, which is a massive, massive number, he's still under contract, but there was a thought that maybe he opts out and then he just does a shorter deal for more overall money, less annually. It happens. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe they like Paul enough to be like, hey, we'll pay the option. We still want to sign you after that. Who knows? I don't know the answers to those things, but Paul not being healthy, if it were an early exit, and then you're really worried about his future health-wise. But that in itself, is, as I'm finishing the thought, is irresponsible. So I'm going to stop myself there and get to the next one that's an irresponsible storyline that's less irresponsible. But if your Kawhi angst and his future with the Clippers is at zero, I would say adjust the dial up a little bit on that one. I don't have info on this. Kawhi is as unpredictable as anyone. People that would say it's only leaned in one direction that Kawhi ultimately would sign the extension because of the money and being a little bit older, and they're going to pay him whatever they can pay him and pay him beyond everybody else for somebody that's been on an injury maintenance program now for multiple years. So why would he turn down any of that extra money? But you don't know with him. And if they get bounced in the first round, to think, unless it's like some secret done deal that I don't already know about, I got to tell you, like, it's a weird... It would, because it's Kawhi, you would have to be so worried. Like, what if this guy just says, nope, I'm going somewhere else? And for everybody like, oh, he would never do that. He's already done it. So I really wonder how weird the Kawhi projecting stories could get. Not saying they'd be accurate, but how weird those could get if the Clippers get bounced in the first round. I want to talk about two instances that happened last night that I knew would lead almost every show today. And I wish I could have bet money and made money on, like, oh, I bet you this will be the topic. And that's the fan interaction and the bullshit that we saw in the Sixers-Wizards game. And then it looks like Trae Young got spat on by a fan at MSG. I don't know exactly what happened there. I've seen the film, but we know for 100% that Westbrook had popcorn dumped on him as he was entering the tunnel. I find it really weird that a Celtics fan would show up to a Sixers-Wizards game, by the way. But when I hear about the punishment debate topic, I check out. I just do. And I know you kind of have to do it, but it really becomes like a contest to be the most pissed off about what actually happened. No one's who's real is defending the popcorn throwing guy. Like, the guy's an asshole. All right. I don't know where our listeners are on the heckling thing, right? It can get to an age where you're like uncomfortable to be around. Like, I get younger guys being drunk and yelling stuff. Like, it's kind of like part of it. And maybe some of you never did it and you think even young guys doing it is stupid. I just have more of a threshold of tolerance for younger guys acting like idiots and saying stuff, but certainly not anything that we saw where you're actually like dumping stuff on a player, because I mean, it goes without saying it's absurd. But watching it on TV, it's like, wait, you're mad? You think you're mad about what happened? Wait until I get my 5 minutes and I'm going to show you how mad I am. Because then it's like punishment. You go, okay, well, what needs to happen? Like, all right, ban him from the arena. For how long? Because nobody's going to say 24-25 season seems about right. And then he can come back 25-26. Because then if you said that, you'd be like, you're not taking this seriously enough. You'd be like, all right, what's the right thing? All right, ban him for life? Okay. I'm sitting here be like, all right, fine, ban him for life. I don't care. You think I care about this fucking guy? I don't. I don't care about him at all. But I am auto-tune out on, let's come up with the right level of punishment. So it seems like, so you know how fierce I am on this topic. There is a disconnect, right? There's a disconnect, I believe, between, you know, famous people, public figures, and non-famous people, non-public figures, despite what you may think about your wellness page on Instagram, Junior at Wisconsin. But there's almost this idea that, hey, well, if you have this life and you are this person and you are famous, then this is what you signed up for. And when I'm in a moment where I want to feel better about myself by dumping on you, I get to do it. And you're supposed to just deal with it, and you're never supposed to react. And that's just the deal. That's the deal that we've all made here in American society. And I'm sure, you know, look, it's not like it doesn't happen in Europe either, but hey, famous person, deal with my bullshit because that's just the deal. And I don't think it's ever been worse than it is right now because we have access to all this different stuff. But when something bad happens in a game, I'd ask somebody like, well, what do you think there is a version of this where it never happens? Like, do you believe that that's even possible? Do you believe that we get to a point where you have thousands of games, millions of fans, and that there's going to be a 0% incident rate? Because that's just not going to happen. It's not going to happen. You know, LeBron jumps in. I mean, what Westbrook went off, and he has every right to be super pissed off. You lose, you're hurt, you're in the tunnel, they're dumping popcorn on you, a guy that would never say anything to your face in a real interaction where there could be something, you know, costly happening to you physically. You would never, that guy would never say anything to Westbrook. I mean, honestly, anytime you've ever had anybody come up to you, and then as soon as it's face to face, it's always like, oh, I mean, hell, even on Twitter, you can be like, what are you talking about? If you do that, and then they'll say, like, oh, big fan, and then they retweet your reply. But when I'll see, you know, LeBron tweet about it, be like, the NBA has to do something. NBA has to do something, because there's also something that's happened more and more in society. And that is there any way that I can make my current situation look worse than it actually is? Right? Is there a way that I can present this as if me, NBA player, is a victim in this case? And in this case, yes, Westbrook is a victim, and certainly Trae Young in that spot at MSG. But when I see LeBron go like, the NBA needs to address this, it literally, the incident had been minutes old, first of all. And I know that LeBron's doing it to make sure that the NBA is held accountable, but do you think this is an actual NBA problem? Because I'd ask you again, is there any version of live interaction with fans and players in these settings where nothing is ever going to happen? Okay, because that's not going to happen. This isn't Adam Silver's fault. There's nothing to do to make sure this is avoided 100%. So when it happens, it's kind of like, hey, we're all going to sound off and show you how mad we are. The media is going to jump in and be like, the NBA needs to step up. You need to ban this guy. Fine, ban him. You need to embarrass him, arrest him, simple assault. Fine, go ahead, do all those things. I would never argue against any of it. But when it's presented as the league needs to do something, like beyond what? Like empty the arenas forever? Not have, you know, like just not have, we just tried that, by the way. And I don't think you're going to want that on the revenue split. I'll never forget like the first wake up call of heckling where I felt like an absolute asshole. Middlebury, Vermont. UVM, Middlebury lacrosse game. UVM wins. We're all going back to the parking lot to our cars. Middlebury player on a golf cart. I think he was actually hurt. And he was being carted off to like a training room. And I said something like, yeah, you know, we got you or something stupid. It wasn't nasty. It wasn't like that. It was just me, bunch of guys. We're all looking at each other. He's carted off. We're all non-players going back to the car, excited because, you know, those are all the roommates. They're all our best friends. It was a nice win. And the Middlebury lacrosse player just looked back and was like, play a sport. And it was one of the top five loser moments of my life where I felt like such a fucking clown. And I was like, yeah, I have no retort, none. And he was so dismissive and he was so right and he delivered the line perfectly. And there was just silence amongst my group of friends because he was right. And trust me, it didn't bother anyone as much as it bothered me to not be a Division I athlete. So he hit me right in the soul. And I got to tell you, that stuck with me for a long time. It's been almost 25 years. And I just, for anybody who's on the heckling, antagonizing players side of thing, just bring that lesson with you next time you're sitting in the loge section. This episode is brought to you by Arby's. I remember my first visit to Arby's. I went with my grandfather, fresh out of WWII. I reached for his hand. He declined my grasp. I was worried about the options. I said, I know they dominate the roast beef world, but is there going to be anything for me? And here's the thing. There is. Well, now is the chance to try Arby's and find your favorite sandwich. With a wide range of options, see for yourself that Arby's sells more than roast beef. Plus, for a limited time, Arby's rewards members get one free sandwich with purchase every week in April, online only. Simply join Arby's Rewards and order ahead today. Order on the app or arbys.com. Excited to have John Hollinger join us. He was one of my favorite guests back in the day, back in one of the original podcasts, going back well over a decade now.
Yeah.
At ESPN, senior NBA with The Athletic and part of the Memphis Grizzlies front office from 2012 to 2019. It's been a long time, John. What's up?
I'm doing great. How you been?
Good. So there's a bunch of stuff that I want to get to. And, you know, we've been trying to book you for weeks. So now to have you on the day after that Gobert game, yeah, probably not great timing for some of the discussion that I wanted to have. I'm not an anti-Gobert guy, though, so I don't want to do that first. I think the big Bill and I were talking about it, too, because you have an MVP vote, correct?
I do not have an actual
vote. Oh, you don't?
No. I wrote a column as if I had a ballot, but I do not have a ballot.
All right. Yeah, because probably the front office thing, they probably weren't in a hurry to give it back to you anyway. So that you never know. I don't know how it all works. Okay, so your MVP ballot, if it existed, but for the purposes of The Athletic, was what?
It was Nikola Jokic won. Then I had Rudy Gobert second and Steph Curry third.
Okay, I think the Gobert one is the one that blew a lot of people's minds. So
sure. Yeah.
Let's go.
I think people understand the defense part, I think, right? Like, he's going to be defensive player of the year. He's the best defensive player in the league right now, you know, protects the rim, all that. I think his offensive value gets underestimated. Like, the whole system revolves around him, even though he doesn't have the ball in a lot of ways. He's running around A to B to C, screen, 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 rim run, rim run, rim run. And he's kind of like the Energizer Bunny, even though he's so big that he keeps running around to do all this. And he's so effective as a rim runner because he's just so long that the whole defense has to suck in. And that's what makes all the three-point shooting they surround him with so effective, is that these guys are taking, you know, lick their fingers corner threes because the guy from the weak side has to suck in so hard to take away the lob to Gobert. So I think as an offensive threat, he gets really underestimated. And so to me, Utah had the best record in the league, and their system is built around him, not just defensively, but offensively. And so, like, in terms of value, like, I think, and he didn't, the other thing he and Jokic both had going for them, of course, is they didn't miss any games, whereas most of the other contenders missed considerable time. And so when you ask yourself who is the most valuable over the course of this regular season, to me, he was second.
The numbers for Gobert have always been something, like, I remember the first time seeing them and and understanding, like, years ago. I remember, like, I'll never forget, because Zach Lowe, like, was going back and forth with me, and he's like, hey, who do you have for this or whatever? And he was like, have you seen some of the Gobert numbers? And I go, they're absurd. The off-court stuff.
Yeah.
The net rating defensively for him. Because, you know, as somebody who has basically been one of, I would say, one of the most important voices in analytics being understood, and just the value of the things that we look at versus what we used to look at traditionally, you deserve a lot of credit for that. So when you started to understand those, you'd go, this is real? Like, this on-off is real with him? Like, this is crazy how far and away. And if you look at some of the box score plus-minus stuff, where he is defensively, the same way that I've argued Steph offensively in comparison to the rest of the league is off the charts, and all those things are great. I think the problem with having him second overall, at least on my side of it, is that when I was going through synergy and his per possession stuff, like, I think it's 82% of all of his offensive players are like dependent plays. It's almost like tall Klay Thompson, Klay's first 2 years, where everything was Klay off of someone else.
Right. So he's not, people have a lot of trouble with the MVP not being the guy dribbling the ball 15 times and then taking a 20-foot pull-up, right? Like, that's just our idea of what the MVP should be, right? And he's not that guy.
Exactly. But so
he's also creating a lot for other people without ever touching the ball. So I think that's the part that gets missed.
So how would you look at it then from a front office standpoint? Like, would you, when you're looking at him, and you would hear, say, a media member just trash Gobert and say, all right, yeah, but a lot of this is just hard rolls. It's offensive rebounds. If you post him up, nope, there's no stretching the floor. And the way we're so enamored with bigs that can stretch the floor, all that kind of stuff. Like, what would you talk about in a front office conversation when you would know that there's so many people in the media that look at Gobert and actually think he's incredibly overrated now, or would look at your vote and think it's absurd?
I just know from our time in Memphis, I mean, we were a heavily, heavily interior team. We could not score against Utah. I mean, that's how you can see his value, at least from our perspective, is if we beat them, it was like 76-73, you know, And this was, I mean, and this was even kind of the younger version of Gobert, who's probably, you know, wasn't quite at the level maybe he's played this year. This to me has been his best season by far. Even last season, I thought he actually slipped a lid for a bit from his previous Defensive Player of the Year level. And this year he's gone back up and even exceeded it to me. To play at that size with that level of energy, I think the whole game is really underestimated.
I've seen, you know, I've made a joke this year that Boston, when they played Utah, seemed to be the only team that didn't understand what Gobert does at the rim. Like, you'll just say, like, hey, challenge shot blockers. And it's like, yeah, but don't challenge him. And game two with Memphis is a great example of it, because I think there's two sides of the argument with it too, where you go, he changed that game in that a couple minute stretch, not just with the two blocks that he had, but he had three hard rolls where he finished. And it was like this 2 minute stretch. And that kind of changed the game. And then, you know, Mitchell came back in, and then Memphis just wouldn't go away. So credit to them. But I think there's another part of it where you go, okay, John Morant, who's basically a drive guy, he's not stretching the floor at all. He goes for 70 plus points, only behind Mikan for his first two playoff games ever. So if Gobert's making that kind of impact, how come Ja's putting up those numbers? Which, again, I think I already know where your answer is going to be, but some people will see it as simply as that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, watching those first two games, I mean, Ja got a lot of those points off stopping short of Gobert and making that floater. And they also, I mean, obviously game one too, they had the fouls on Gobert, and they kind of abused Favors in the minutes he was in the game. So they got some money there too. But I mean, John Morant was tremendous. I mean, is the other answer, obviously. I mean, he played great these last two games.
Yeah, because if you go through it, and I pulled it up, you know, if you go net rating, defensive rating, I mean, net rating, like, this is where I did a filter this morning, 55 regular season games, which can even eliminate some of the guys because so many guys missed games.
Yeah.
But, you know, Gobert's net rating, and this is basically the guys that played 55 games regular season, he's number one in the NBA at plus 16. And the guys that are behind him are Niang, Ingles, and Royce O'Neal in the NBA, which tells you, because those guys are out there with Gobert, the first non-Jazz player is Giannis, who's plus 10. He's 5 points behind Gobert, which is just a galaxy away when you start to look at some of these numbers. But then I'll look at, okay, well, what happens in certain playoff matchups? Because we've seen it in the regular season too. What is Steph looking to do? He wants to get Gobert, and he wants to attack and stretch him away from the floor. Chris Paul, if Phoenix plays Utah and Chris Paul's healthy, it's a long ways away if it even happens. I can tell from the regular season matchups, he's hunting for Gobert. So in the context of, like, numbers versus what's actually happening out there, I think there's at least, that's part of my argument for at least not having Gobert second overall in the MVP vote, where I go, I still have a hard time with him with some of the stuff, even though I do understand the numbers and how impressive they are, that we still have guards that are going, I actually want him because in a switch and getting him further away, I can expose him more than I'm worried about.
Well, the other reason you want him on the switch, though, is that means he's not at the rim.
Right.
Right. I mean, like, if you get, because, like, if Niang's out there, you want Niang. The problem is, once you get by Niang, you still have to deal with Gobert at the rim. Whereas if you have Gobert out on the perimeter with you and you get by him, okay, I can finish over Bogdanovich. Like, that's not a big deal. So I think there's another piece of that too.
And it's also part of just playing with a five, is that people are hunting him to try to get him away and get, because I don't care who Gobert is, once he has to start backpedaling against Dame, against Chris Paul, against Steph, it's going to be over for him the same way.
It's hard for any big. It's why they do that with all their bigs, right? Yeah.
And that's kind of why I always love Garnett, and why he'd be the perfect five now, is that you never want to switch. Like, you were like, actually, I don't want you out here because I can't get past you, which was the absurdity of what Garnett was in his prime.
Yeah. And I mean, you saw that last year with Bam Adebayo a little bit, where now teams have figured out, to attack Miami, they actually have to go other places and not try to get that switch with Bam, and instead try to kind of maroon him on the other side of the floor if you can.
Yeah, because the Jaw, like, they go to Quinn Snyder, and, you know, everybody's like, hey, how can you stop this guy? And he's like, we got to stop him going vertical. And you're just like, good luck, because you can't. Like, Conley tried, O'Neal tried. And you're right, because the dangerous part about Ja, who I'd put him in that floater group, maybe Trey's the best at it. I mean, I don't have the floater numbers in front of me. I think Steph's terrific as well. But when you can stop short And then even Ja can stand there for a second or two and everybody's freaked out about what he's going to do. And it actually creates space just by the anxiety of what Ja, because his jump is quicker than everybody else. His vertical is insane.
And so, he makes floaters you watch where he's like jumping sideways 5 feet and then shooting the floater. Like the degree of difficulty on his floaters is actually pretty impressive. Like Trae Young's floaters are pretty good too, but Trae's more straight line. Like his floaters are impressive because he's running full speed and then shoots a floater. And you're like, wow, you can do that. And with Ja, it's more just the athleticism of his floaters where he's moving so much left to right or north south in space while he's taking it.
Yeah, the angle part of it is really impressive. It's almost like these mini Euro steps involved in also getting off to like a Zion level jump. We did this in the open a little bit because I'll ask, and you were gone, just so our listeners, and you were gone before Ja was taken, correct?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. I mean, it was there's some gray area there, but effectively, yes.
Maybe I'll ask you about the gray area. Okay, because we do know this, like when front offices have changeover.
Yeah,
I think it always blows fans' minds away that they're like, why are these guys?
They made the change after the season, but I was still employed by them. I was still technically employed by them when we drafted Ja, but I wasn't in the room.
All right. But you were part of the, I imagine, you know, they're not going to not want you as a resource. So we're, because now it's, as we touched on the beginning, it's like you're starting to hear people be like, hey, Ja should have gone one. I'm not necessarily ready to go there, but where are you on that?
I mean, Zion was pretty awesome this year, right?
So yeah, like, it wasn't like wasn't good, right? Right.
It's still probably default to that. The thing you wonder about Zion is the longevity, and you know, if you're going to get, you know, are you going to get 10 years of Ja at this level and 5 years of Zion at his level, you know, before everything breaks down? I think it's fair to ask that question.
Yeah, it is. And I also have moments with Ja where I feel like he's going to have the most slam ball-ish type ACL injury we've ever seen in a basketball game.
Right. He's so wiry and the forces he's putting on that body. I know. You kind of cringe sometimes and wonder. Or if he's just going to crumple in a heap going for one of these poster dunks on the wrong 7-footer. Yeah.
I know. I don't want him to change anything about it, but some of his landing. But you're right. I mean, it's safe or better if you were going health-wise, it would still be Ja over Zion. Was there ever any... You said you weren't in the room, I guess. I mean, was there ever any discussion?
I mean, all I know is like I had been, you know, up until that point, like I had gone on scouting trips to see Ja because I was still part of that front office. So like we really liked him. We didn't know we were getting the second pick, remember? We were still like in the playoff race the first half of the season and then the bottom fell out and we moved up from 9-2 in the lottery also. It wasn't really a heavy debate at the time. But the other guy everyone was talking about was Barrett. And like, we knew we liked Ja better than Barrett. Like we were pretty sure about that. Ja versus Zion, it didn't really come up that much. I think Zion was such a default for everyone at number one. That would have been hard.
Yeah, I'm glad you answered the Barrett part of it too, because I, you know, going into that year, Barrett was supposed to be one. And then pretty quickly you were like, yeah, that's probably not going to happen. And then you could just hear, as you guys do, like more and more people that I would talk to, like, have you watched Ja yet? Like, do not fall for the competition thing here. Like, this guy's nuts. Like, he's all that, and he's in the conversation. The thing I always liked about you is you always felt like a different media member when you were in the media. So what was the biggest shock to you once you transitioned from media to working for a team?
Biggest shock. I don't know if shock is the right word, but... The amount of time you have to spend or the amount of time a front office spends dealing with things that aren't really about the basketball, I guess. And that's actually increased. And I mean, I talked to people this year, I know with the COVID stuff, like it's taken over their lives and they like, can I just watch a game for like 1 hour, you know? And thankfully that's starting to calm down now, but a lot of the stuff with the health and maintenance of players has become a much bigger deal. Even from the time I started has become a much huger thing. I mean, you saw it with the Mitchell thing with game one, there's just so many more people involved. It's not just the trainer doing, you know, thumbs up, thumbs down anymore. And so that's a whole layer, I think, that's been added on that A, you have to do a lot of work just to understand, and B, to manage and kind of have all the left hand and right hand knowing what everyone's doing and have all the processes nailed down. And when it, you know, when it breaks, you can get a situation like what happened with Mitchell in game one.
Yeah, the minutes discussions have been, you know, a completely new world in the way that we've talked about it. And I would say, I think it almost leans towards obsessive, but I mean obsessive in that I still think there's a lot of guesswork. I think a bunch of smart people will get together. They'll get somebody on the medical side to say this, yeah, this is the way to go about it. And then I'm like, okay, but do you know that? Or are we just trying to make something more complicated? And it's already complicated enough. Sometimes I'll argue that people will try to make simple complicated. In this case, we know the minutes and health and projection and what's the best way to have maintenance for these amazing athletes. And it's like, are you trying to make it even more? Did you ever feel like you understood something better, or was it just guesswork with more data?
To me, it was risk management, right? So you're doing risk management in an area of gray, because you can say, okay, we know these loads correspond to this amount of risk, but you can't definitively say like, oh, minute 37, that's it, he's going to snap in half, you know? And so it becomes art more than science at some point, but I do think, though, that it was necessary to put in guardrails at certain points, like especially when we had Mark coming back from the foot injury at the beginning of that next season. I think those guardrails were really helpful to prevent a re-injury. And, you know, we were able to get him through the whole season and made the All-Star team. So you can see where the benefit comes in, but it could be... The process of getting there can be hugely frustrating for everybody, including the players.
Yeah, I can't imagine, because you've got coaches, and if they've been around longer, some assistants are going to be like, you're going to be kidding me. And then sometimes
this isn't the way we used to do it. Yeah. And also, I mean, the player, like, they're competitors, man. They want, like, they want to be out there. And like, even if, you know, even if they're obviously injured to the point that like something is dangling, they're like, come on, man, let me go, you know? So when you're just saying like preventive rest, you're not going to play tonight, they're like, what? Like, what are you talking about? So that whole discussion, I think now, thankfully, you know, as times have evolved, I think there's more understanding even on the player side now that, okay, this is a thing that can help extend my career and keeps me healthy and whatnot. So there's benefits to it. But it's still a very tricky discussion to have all the way around. Just to understand what's happening, then to herd all the cats and get everybody pointed in the same direction as to what your strategy is going to be.
How challenging is it to actually pull off a trade?
You know, it's weird. Sometimes it depends who you're dealing with, and it depends on the complexity of it. I've actually had a trade that was done in one call with the guy on the other line, literally just going, okay. and
does that make you nervous? Are you like, wait a minute, maybe I don't want to do this?
No, it was close enough to the trade deadline that I thought that was, it was when you see, once you get within a couple hours of the trade deadline, all the bullshit goes away and people just, I can swear in this, right? And because people just have to show their cards, right? And so people that have been bluffing with you for 3 months, they eventually have to come clean if you haven't taken the bait on their bluff. So it's interesting though, because there are some teams that you just know that it's probably not going to happen. Like, just whatever the personal dynamics are of the relationships in the front offices, or just the way the person on the other side operates, you just know that, okay, we're probably not getting a deal done with this team, like, ever.
Yeah, because I think for all the people that, you know, have covered it and have done it for a long time, and we've seen more transition. I don't know if David Kahn has ruined it for media members forever, but I don't know if you're tight with Khan, so I apologize if that's
no.
But the relationship part of it is completely dismissed in your ability to do the job. Mm-hmm. And whether it's the agents or other front office people, I mean, player to player, there's just going to be a different level of conversation. Doesn't mean that they're going to trust each other. As you know, on the media side and the front office side, there are There are decision makers that talk their players up to a point where it's just absurd. And then there's other guys that just like to talk. And there's other guys that will never talk because they feel like just by talking on the phone that they could subconsciously give you some kind of lean that's a competitive disadvantage, all these different things. So I always feel like it's so much harder to find ways to change your team in the NBA. I mean, football, you can make all sorts of cuts. Coaching has more of an impact. Baseball, there's less financial restrictions. But for an NBA front office to say like, hey, we have a real need and we're going to figure something out, there's still a pretty good chance you're never going to be able to address it.
Yeah, or you have to grossly overpay to address it. Yeah, because you just have a limited number of partners between the salary cap and the type of players who are available that could actually address your need. And then the position of those teams, like if there's somebody on another team who you're like, oh, he'd be perfect here, but that's the team we're competing with at the top of the standings, then obviously they're not going to trade you that guy. So you end up sifting through some maybe suboptimal options that can still help you or overpaying a little bit. I mean, when you're a contender, those are the types of discussions you're having, definitely. And, we were kind of in that position for the majority of the time I was there. So it does get tricky.
Did you go into it thinking like, I'm going to have an approach, like I want to always be positive? Because, you have to worry about the ownership conversations that happen where owners can get on the phone with each other, depending on who's president, GM, who's making decisions, who might be more forthcoming. I would almost wonder if you'd have your guard up a little bit more because you'd be like, hey, John, was calling about the roster. And then you're sitting there being like, we love Bryce Cotton. Like, what do you mean? just talking your own guys up, like what your strategy was as a guy talking with other front offices.
Usually you want to be somewhat truthful because the team, like if a team doesn't know what you're trying to do or what you're looking for, it's hard for them to imagine and be creative in terms of ways to help you that you might not have thought of. It's just so much harder to arrive at a trade at that point. So if you're actually serious about doing something, it does help to be somewhat honest about it. Where it gets tricky that like when they ask you about a player on your team, typically, even if the guy sucks, you're gonna be like, oh, we love that guy. What are you talking about? And then as it gets closer to the trade deadline, you call them back and they're like, actually, would you take a second round pick to take him off our hands? Bigger picture, I think it's like the best approach to me is like relatively honest with about like a 20% fantasy layer on top. And that to me usually gets you to your best outcomes where you're still talking about things that are somewhat realistic. So they're going to stay on the phone with you. They understand what you're trying to do. But you're not negotiating against yourself either.
Back to this season. Who did you pick for the finals?
Who did I pick at the start of the season? I think
you can do now. I mean, if you want to.
Yeah, whatever. Right.
If you want to give us the start, I know how some guys can be like, well, I picked in the beginning and you're like, all right, whatever.
I think I had the Clippers and did I have Philadelphia in the East at the beginning of the year? I think I might have. I mean, this is before Brooklyn got Harden, obviously. Right now, Brooklyn has the most talent. To me, it's the question of can those three guys all stay on the court through an entire playoffs, because all three of them have had some pretty serious health issues recently. And so, is the wear and tear of the postseason going to knock them out? If they're all three on the court, Milwaukee and Philadelphia are really interesting matchups because they don't have the size to deal with them. But I just wonder if they're just going to score so much that it doesn't matter.
Does Brooklyn make you change the way you look at like what the acceptable level of defense is for a team?
Not really. It's more like, you're just trying to do points scored versus points against, right? Like if you have the best offense ever, then you can, what's acceptable for defense obviously changes. So I think they're just inevitably, their pathway is just being so ridiculous on offense that it doesn't matter. Now they've actually played some pretty good defense in these first two games against Boston, but I also think, Boston, to quote our former player, Matt Barnes, Boston brought some spoons to a gunfight.
Yeah. Now, Boston, when you go in 20 minutes for Jabari Parker and he's actually getting buckets for you, you're probably in some trouble in the playoffs. Would you rather have this Brooklyn offense or the Golden State one with Durant?
Oh, that's a great question. Do I get to keep Draymond? Then I'd rather have.
Yeah, no, for I'm defense, giving, right? I'm, like, if you say, hey, this, because we realize that too, historically, and I brought this up before, that yes, Brooklyn per 100 is who they are, but they're per 100 in today's game, which is still absurdly more offensive, you know, than even 5 years ago. So 4 years ago. So my point is that I get what the numbers say, but I'd rather have those five guys from Golden State than I would these five.
The thing that Golden State had that Brooklyn doesn't yet have is kind of they were so in sync with each other, you know, that it wasn't just that they were all individually awesome. It was that then their system, like, it just all fit and worked. So Brooklyn's getting there, but there's still a lot of your turn, my turn to them. And that may still take a while to get out of their system.
You picked Phoenix in the first round over the Lakers. And we know that this is before the Paul part of this. So that changes everything. He's not looked good when he's even been out there. I think his projection of his own health is probably a little bit higher than it feels like, at least what we've seen. We'll see what game three looks like. I was surprised because I just felt like with the size, there were moments in the regular season and Davis in that last regular season game who just dominated Phoenix. And then, you know, for Davis, as much as I love him, he always feels like he needs a bit of a wake-up call sometimes to get himself going. But what was it about that matchup when both were healthy that you still liked Phoenix coming out of it?
But the biggest thing to me is I just didn't think LeBron was 100%, and I don't think he's looked 100% in these first two games. So I thought full strength Phoenix was good enough to beat not full strength Lakers. And I thought that bore out in game one. Now game two, obviously it didn't work out the same way. They just were able to load up so much on Booker without Paul being there. They do need Chris Paul full strength by, I would say, game four at the latest in order to win this series. So we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, the other thing with the Lakers, I think, I didn't allude to this when I wrote about it, but Monty Williams coached Anthony Davis in New Orleans. And I think he has a pretty good idea of what you want to do against him to take away some of his strengths. And because if you make him a jump shooter, like, he can make them, but it's just, you know, you're not scared. Like, it's not messing up your defense. It's just like, okay, great shot. Let's go down the other end. And there's not a ton of shooting around all that for the Lakers either, especially if LeBron isn't in superhero mode. So I still think the Lakers are going to have some issue scoring unless they can get that version of LeBron back.
What would you do if you're running the front office for the Clippers and they get bounced in the first round by the Mavs?
Update my resume? No, I'm kidding. I mean, Ballmer is not known for his patience, so that's going to be an interesting thing there. I think it's interesting because the focus has been, I think, on the guard situation and how they don't have a real point guard, and it puts a lot of pressure on Kawhi. And that's part of it. But the part I don't get is them getting lit on defense. Like, you have Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, Patrick Beverley. Like, you have elite perimeter 1 through 3, and Luka is just shredding you these first two games. And they just look confused, like not on the same page of what they're even trying to do, let alone whether it's the correct tactic. They're not even executing the tactic correctly. Just so many botched switches and like stuff you don't expect from a veteran team in the playoffs. It's been really odd to see. But if you were going to do something with the roster, I think, you know, you probably try to trade for an upgraded point guard. They don't really have any assets left, remember, after that Paul George deal.
Do you think George's market? What if Kawhi's like, hey, I'm coming back, but I'm done with George? I mean, what would George's market?
I mean, that's the other part of it. And who's even out there for you to trade Paul George for, right? I think that's the bigger question. Like, we want to get rid of Paul George. Okay, what are we parlaying him into? Who's the other star that's out there right now? I mean, that's part of why John Wall and Russell Westbrook got traded for each other. There was just nobody else left for them to be traded for, right? Between their contracts and where they were in their careers. So something else has to happen in another city where somebody of that caliber is available to become Kawhi's new tag team partner. That's the really tricky part.
Okay, before we let you go, we keep it real on this podcast. So okay. I have like two quick ones for you because we haven't talked about this.
Okay.
But when I went to be like, oh, I'll hit up Hollinger, and then I was like, oh, he unfollowed me. I'm not great on Twitter, but what do you think was your breaking point with me where you were like, you know what? Fuck this guy. Like, was it a Grizzlies observation? We know it wasn't anything political because I don't know that I touch on any of that stuff. Hey, we get it. You like the SEC. I'm not anti-UVA, so I don't know that it was that. I just, for the staff here, we want to know. I was like, oh, okay. And don't follow me now because I brought it up because I'll block you. All right. I'm not looking for the follow. Do you remember when it was like, all right, enough of this fucking Russillo guy?
I think I was working for the Grizzlies and was streamlining some of the media people out of my accounts.
Yeah, all right. Maybe.
I think that's the honest answer. I wish I had a more humorous answer than that, but I think that's what actually happened.
All right. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Okay, so then the other one, this one might be a little dicier because I don't know if I want to bring up the player name.
Okay.
I won't unless you want me to.
Okay.
But you know, I thought we had a good relationship, but I didn't ever like work you as a source. You know what I mean? Like I didn't bug you all the time. I'd say hi every now and then. Yeah. There's a couple times we talked pre-draft and we would just chat about some players. Yeah. I always felt like we were on the same page. And it wasn't like I was like, hey, tell me everything you're doing with the Grizzlies. Cause I also know you don't ask guys those kinds of questions. And honestly, you know, unless you have the best relationship with someone, they're not going to open up that way to you. Right. Cause we weren't that kind of close. I asked about a player that I actually didn't have a ton on, a foreign player in the draft, and you were like, don't waste your time, sucks, can't play. And I was like, oh, all right. He's still playing.
Oh, shit. Okay.
And I'm thinking, dude, he's a first rounder. So I was like, did he just go like, and you ended up, you guys never had him. You never, so I could tell you who the player, but it was funny because I was like, did he just lie? Did he just lie to me to be like, I'm just going to lie to Russillo about this? Or maybe you just didn't like this guy. I don't know. I mean, it's tough for you now because you're dealing blind here because you don't know.
I'm dealing blind, but I'm pretty sure I probably whiffed on the guy because I don't think I would have said that just as a smokescreen.
That's what I thought.
It wouldn't have been worth the trouble for me to smokescreen something like that. Because like I said, it's not like we picked the guy, right?
So, no, you never had him. Do you want me to tell you who it is or do we want to just not go there? If you're 1% hesitant, we don't have to do it. Don't do it for the sake of the pod.
You can tell me after the show.
Okay. All right. Perfect. We'll do it that way. Well, we're not going to be able to keep in touch though, because I'm going to block you if you follow me. So. please check out Hollinger's work on The Athletic. The playoff coverage has been terrific. You guys do a great job. And as always, appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. La Quinta by Wyndham has everything you need for your next business trip. From free high-speed Wi-Fi to fitness centers to free bright side breakfast with fresh waffles, eggs, and more, book direct at LQ.com. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. This is a real treat for me, and I hope for some of you who know who he is or at least are going to learn about him today, Esoteric SO of Czarface rap group, new album, Super What, is out. And for fans of MF Doom, it's a chance to hear him again. Before we get to the MF Doom part of this, because I definitely want to talk about your story. And I know about you through my brother. My brother's a lot cooler than me. He was first a DJ, a music producer now. I mean, he's making his music. He's doing all those things. But he used to go to, like, was it Middle East? And he would go to some of those, like, underground shows. And he opened for Mr. Lif one time when he was super young. And, like, it blew his mind because he was, like, he was so cool to me. He saw Jay Live do the deal where Jay Live does the intro where he's mixing his own while he's rapping over the top of it. Yeah. So he's freaking out. And then he knew about you. And he's like, you got to check out Czarface. You got to check out Esoteric. You got to check out this whole deal because, you know, it's Inspected Deck from Wu-Tang and this whole deal. Like, so what was it like for you? What was your start like? Because Boston, as we all know, is not exactly a place where it's easy to break out and rap.
Yeah, right. I think we just started out like anyone else that grew up on the culture of like hip hop and the late 80s, early 90s, Yo MTV Raps had a huge impression on all of us. And you start, you know, really falling in love with the music. And then, of course, you want to create some yourself. And it just, I fell in love with it. And it started probably, realistically, I think I first recorded a record really early 90s. And started doing talent shows at like the Shabu Roller Rink and a couple other spots. Then I graduated to the Middle East in the Western Front. And it's just kind of a Boston and Cambridge thing for a while. And then soon there was an independent hip hop boom. You press your own vinyl and it goes everywhere. And then the rise of the internet. And then people are in Italy know your name. And then you're going out to Italy doing shows there. And it's like, wow, it gets to your head. But yeah, I think it's just the timing was right on our side, because in 1988 I just thought it was magic making a record. There's no way you could do it without a record label.
How many people told you we're almost the exact same age? The comic book references are hilarious to me. I'm like, I'm probably like you, where I get mad at the Secret Wars movie because I'm like, the comic was way cooler and what they did. And this isn't Secret Wars. Like, what are you guys calling this Secret Wars? That's not what this is. which is such an I'm afraid to even expose myself that I understand what that means. But I can't imagine how many people were like, what are you going to do? Like, how many people told you to not pursue what you've done with your life?
A lot, man. And I think that's the fuel. You know, you want to prove people wrong. You want to let them know that, you know, nothing is really going to take you out of the game. You're going to stand strong and get up. You know, you fall down 8 times, get up 9 times. I feel like it's been like that forever for us. But I think that gives us a lot of that energy. People doubt us. And then, you know, but here we are, you know, and a lot of our contemporaries have trailed off and done other things, and we're still doing what we love, you know? So I think in the beginning, you know, my dad actually was who I think most people would think would be the person that would want to steer you away from something like that. But he was actually, he embraced it, he encouraged it. And then he started trying to fall in love with hip hop and, like, you know, listening to Stetsasonic and EPMD and things like that. And he supported me in that way. And I think that he was an English teacher. So I learned to play with words a little bit, and I felt like I could impress him, even though I know, you know, it's not Shakespeare, but it's you know, a way of using the English language in a way that, I don't know, that it's effective, touches people in a way.
Who was your guy then growing up? I mean, I imagine we probably have a lot of crossover on like the first, because I just, you know, look, I remember everybody, first of all, was Run DMC, because you were like, this is so cool, because it was like, it felt like it was only them. And that's only them for the way we were exposed to it, not, you know, living in a city, or at least for me, you know, I'm not speaking for you, not being in New York City at the start, all this stuff. And then, you know, whether it was, I mean, shit, Rob Bass was cool for us in junior high, you know, Rakim was probably like the first guy. And then, you know, this West Coast thing comes in, but yet it's, you know, Stetsasonic to me was like, how are these guys not more popular? You know what I mean? And I remember the first time I heard Guru's voice and Manifest, and I was like, oh my God, like, what is this? Like, who's this fucking guy? And then, you know, you learn later on, like, how much, you know, DJ Premier and the whole deal. D-Nice, that whole tape, and then getting to know Derek Jones, you know, D-Nice, getting to know him later on in life and be like, no, I'm not kidding you. Like, that was, I made our, I think, seventh grade basketball team come out to that, my set up a tape cassette and come out to My Name Is D-Nice. And that was our layup line deal. And my dad was cool with it. He was like, yeah, whatever you guys want to do. But who were those voices for you early on that you were like, okay, well, you know, this is what I'm about now?
First of all, I think layup lines and coming out to hip hop back then, it was a staple for a lot of kids. Even the kids that were into Guns N' Roses and Aerosmith and all that stuff, they were cool if we came out to Public Enemy, or, you know, because there was, you know, there's the kids on the team that loved hip hop and the kids on the team that loved Guns N' Roses and all that stuff. But like NWA, there was a middle ground there, you know what I'm saying? And you could really express yourself. Like, we'd walk into gymnasiums with a, you know, a big radio blast and PE or something like that. It just gave you a little bit of energy. But my guys, Chuck D, KRS-One, Guru, EPMD, Kool Keith, Ultramag, you know, it really, any one of these guys, man, you know, and I was saying the other day, I was talking to Deck about the Mount Rushmore of MCs, and we have the same ones, you know. There's Kool G Rap, KRS, Chuck D. I would put Ice-T on there too. But it's interesting talking to him about that stuff since he got right in the very early 90s when he could still look up to somebody like Big Daddy Kane in the same way I would. But, you know, when Wu-Tang exploded, they exploded. And it just, the levels changed, you know, where I was and where Deck was. But it's just interesting for his perspective growing up in New York.
So how did that come about then? Like, how did the Inspector Deck connection with you and then the foundation with 7L and Czarface, like, how did that go from, holy shit, this is Wu-Tang, and now, like, I'm in a group with them?
Yeah. We made our first record with Deck together in probably 99. And it was for a 12-inch single, and Deck was a feature. And back then, getting a feature from somebody like Inspector Deck was just unheard of. And the feature game then was not as... it didn't seem like such a staple for people. Like, you have to fill up a record with features. Nowadays, when you drop a record, you know, people want to know, well, who the features on it? I'm like, man, we're the features. we should be the reason you're buying the record. Not because, you know, but I think it's just a reflex for people. You know, even if the greatest rapper of all time is going to drop a record, I still want to know who the guests are, just out of curiosity. But yeah, 99, 98 or something, we made our first record called Speaking Real Words with Deck. And then I was starstruck out of my mind. We recorded it in Brooklyn. And when he first recorded right in front of me, he wrote the rhyme probably in about 15 minutes and just delivered it maybe two takes max. And I was like, this is why Inspector Deck is who he is, you know, because it's just an effortless thing for him. So we kept a relationship throughout the years where we'd send him beats. He'd reject them or he'd take them or, you know, we just kept in touch. And then in 2000 something, maybe 2010, 7L had the idea of forming a group with Inspector Deck, which to me was just heresy. I just didn't think we could ever pull that off. I didn't think Deck would ever be down to do it. And he was down to do it. And then I was just blown away by that and decided to come up with some type of a figurehead for the group, some type of a you know, a representation of the music, and came up with Czarface and the character. And that has transitioned into comics and action figures and that world.
Yeah. I mean, you guys describe Czarface as a hero and a villain. And if you don't know, if you're listening to this right now and you're like, what the hell's going on? Here's the deal. Like, you guys have fun with it. You know, I was lucky enough right before everything kind of shut down, I got to see you up in LA, and I'll admit, like, rap concerts, usually it's not my number one to-do list. You know, I'll be like, all right, some guys, yeah, it's, sometimes you're like, I don't know. And I was like, you know, I wanted to come see you guys because I'd had so much fun in going backwards and learning about everything. And it does have such an old school feel to it. So for guys our age that maybe look at rap now and like, I don't really know what's going on, which isn't entirely fair, by the way, but that's what draw me to you guys. But you're fun about it. It's a fun show, and it is kind of about the beats first, which, you know, I don't want to speak for you guys, but like there's a musical element to it that is beyond some other smaller shows that you may go to where you feel like, okay, I got it, you know?
Yeah, I think it kind of came out that way naturally because that seems to be our common ground, me and Deck, you know what I mean? He grew up in Killer Hill Projects in Staten Island, you know, and I grew up out here in Mass, and I can't talk about some of the things that he grew up with. And I think we connect on the pop culture stuff because we both grew up with comic books. You know, he told me he used to steal comic books from Method Man back in the day. And they had, you know, you go in and Method would go into a store, he'd take the Ghost Rider or whatever it was, be out. And they fostered their love for comics that way. And I think that's a meeting point for us and having fun with it. And we're both, you know, as you said, we're, you know, you and I are the same age and Dex right around there too. And, you know, you can't really at this point in your life, you know, be glorifying some of the things you might have glorified at a younger age. Everyone's a little bit wiser now. And, you know, we just, I think that's kind of where we, you know, make the music and it comes off fun. And I do remember when you came out to that LA show, you hit me and you said forgiveness on the LA hat. And I was mortified that you were there because I, you know, because I saw a picture of you and you had the Red Sox hat on. And I was like, damn. But I was caught up in the moment, man. Plus, you know, Mookie, Manny, Nomai, Mike Loretta, whoever else went to the Dodgers, man. I still like the Dodgers.
It's a great hat. I'm not going to lie. I used to rock one during the summer when I was back home years ago. Okay. So it's somewhere around here. Yeah. Was there ever like when you were hanging out? Because look, you've had Jizza on, who I think is like ridiculous. When I mean, Liquid Swords is still a go-to for me. I don't know that there's 10 rap albums I'll go back to as much as that one.
Yeah.
You know, you've had Method Man on, so you've worked with these guys. And as you mentioned, you were a little starstruck. Was there any resistance where, like, you know, Spectadex bringing you around? You're like, I'm gonna start working with this guy, and guys are like, what was that evolution of those relationships like with dudes learning about you for the first time, being like, who's this guy? Like, what are you doing?
Totally. Yeah, that's what's one of his stories he likes to tell. He got so much shit for working with us. These white boys, you know, I can't believe you're fucking with these white boys. Why aren't you fucking with us and finishing this and doing that? And that's, you know, that's Dex's words telling me. But I think, you know, the music kind of speaks for itself, you know, and I clearly it's been rewarding for us to continue. We've made about 5 or 6 records, maybe more, maybe probably more together, and we have a good working relationship, and I think he respects what I bring to the table with the lyrics, and obviously I respect what he does, and we just, you know, we got a good thing going.
For MF Doom fans, you're going to want to check this out as well, because you'd worked with Doom for a long time. You know, the way he's such a hard guy to describe. Like, rap is so much about, I'm cool, I'm going to take your girl, I'm going to fuck you up. And Doom could make you feel stupid, but he didn't want to be cool about it. Like, he was almost making fun of himself in so many different ways. And if anybody were ever explained to me, like, yeah, there's this guy, it's Doom, wears a mask, and he cuts up all these weird sound bites, and you'd be like, what are you talking about? Rap skits on albums? And what does he do? And then I found this interview from Beef on the sample for Beef Rap, where it was actually a VHS cartoon that he had, a Dr. Doom cartoon, where there's this weird part where Doom's mad and he's telling like one of his guys that he bosses around. Yeah. He's like, all right, you know, with lasers, we're going to do. And there's it might even be Two Measures, where it's this collection. And MF Doom was like, all right, that's what I'm using for the sample in Beef Rap. And you can hear it where there's a part of a laser going off in the cartoon. And because they didn't have the real audio, they used the sample from the VHS tape. And so it's still in there. And when you hear it, if you have an ear, I mean, some people do, some people don't. I hear it, I'm like, oh, that's perfect. And I couldn't get out of my head. And then he built the whole song around it. And, you know, I just am so enamored with him. As you can hear me, and I'm obviously tee this back to you because you're friends with him, you work with him, all this stuff. But like, when he has a line where it says, if these walls could talk, they probably still wouldn't listen. And you're just like, this guy was on another level of storytelling, but in a way his style was storytelling where he was still just talking to himself. And it's so different. And I got my rap friends were like, what the fuck are you listening to? Because, you know, you don't work out to it necessarily. You don't throw it on at parties necessarily. But it's just a collection of brilliance and different ways that he could do things that there's never going to be anyone like him. It's just no point. No one would even bother trying to be like him. It'd be impossible.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And that, you know, as you said, a guy with a mask. You know, I remember going to a Doom show in Boston, it was maybe the second or third date I ever had with my now wife. This was probably 2003, maybe. I don't know. We were just kind of getting together. And I knew Doom was playing down the street, this place called Hibernia. And I'm bringing this girl who's, you know, she likes hip hop and stuff, but, you know, you would think we'd react the same way your buddies would about describing the scenario, you know? So we go in and I'm like, this is the guy we came to see. And he's in the corner of the building with no stage. There's probably 30, 35 people there total. And he's got this mask on and he's rapping, and the 30 people there know every word. They're going crazy. And this was probably right before Mad Villain dropped, and he in Adult Swim raised his profile a lot, and people really caught on to his brilliance. Of course, there was the underground core dating back to the 90s. But, you know, he just had a way with words, and he could speak about himself in third person. He could take on different personas. He could say things that, you know, a villain would say, but not necessarily Daniel Dumoulin would say as a person. You know, he just had a way with bending words, making the most obscure words rhyme multisyllabically, syllable for syllable for syllable, you know, five syllable rhyme schemes. It's just, you're right, there will never be another one.
Okay, so that's, I'm so glad you gave me your first experience seeing him. When was the first time, like, versus maybe meeting him, but meeting him knowing that, like, okay, I might be working with this guy. Like, I don't want to speak for it. Were you friends with him? I mean, was he a close friend?
Well, we grew closer as the time, as, you know, more recent, you know, over the past 4 or 5 years working together. But we shared a bill with him, his first show as MF Doom, because he came out as Zev Love X, KMD, under third base in the early 90s, late 80s. And, you know, and then reinvented himself as MF Doom. And I was a huge fan of KMD, huge fan. I mean, because those guys took the music in a different direction, and it wasn't all Raiders hats and death threats. It was more, you know, common everyday things. And it made me feel, I don't know, put me in a good place, good mood. And then we wound up doing a show with him, and it was his first appearance as MF Doom. But I knew it was Zev Love X from KMD. I don't know how many people knew that there, but I am now on the stage with an icon to me, somebody I had on my wall. And it's just completely different because everyone else in the bill, I consider my peers, my equals, regardless of talent, but he was just on another level. And now here I am about to wet my pants because this is Zev Love X. And, you know, he became MF Doom. So I guess we had a series of run-ins throughout the years. Some of my best friends at Brick Records put out one of his early collaborations with MF Grimm. Photographed the whole thing, did the graphic design and so forth. We just had a long history, but timing has a way of making things work out. So we never worked together until 2015, and then we hit a stride and worked on a couple full-length albums.
Yeah, and again, for people trying to keep up that may not know about him, I mean, the KMD stuff goes back to like 88, and then, you know, the Zev Love X, so it's just him. He was different. I mean, he was different in that he was like he was reinventing himself with these different personas, these different characters. Did it change how he was? Was it like an actor playing a different part and then, you know, playing a different movie part years later? Like, how different would he be? I mean, you're telling me you connected more with the birth of Doom and all that kind of stuff. But but what was he like kind of, you know, just hanging out with as he was going through these different creative processes?
Well, I think the art, the way he'd approach the music is the way a true artist would approach the music. I mean, the mask really represented, you know, it tried to take the focus off him as a person. And that gave him more of a world to explore and created a universe where he could be his character, Doom, you know? And I think it was a stroke of genius. And he's a very private guy. One of the few artists that, as everyone clamors for attention on social media, and does everything they possibly can to try to get, you know, their 30 seconds of fame or their 15,000 likes or whatever. Doom didn't have to do any of that. Doom actually got the energy and the exposure and through the mystery of it all, keeping the mystique. It's just a stroke of genius. And, you know, me, I can't help but go on Instagram and you know, share things from my life. It's just something that is in me. Doom was able to hold all that back and keep everything to himself. And that just only made him stronger and only made the curiosity grow from everyone, you know?
Give me your best Doom story being in a studio working with him. You know, doing some of the stuff you guys did.
we recorded he recorded in Parts Unknown. Me and Def recorded here. So we didn't record the albums together. It was more of an email thing. But we kept in touch a lot virtually. And I think going on our first album, I wanted to put a skit together that was kind of a pay tribute to the first KMD album where they had a lot of voice acting and samples interacting with one another. So him and I worked on that, and I would have to, you know, ask him to say, get out of here and you're not going to rob that store. And he would come back with, you know, a whole file of all of these sound bites. And then I would reverse engineer it to build dialogue around that for the skit. And anytime I sent anything to him, he would send it back intentionally misspelled and in all caps. He would change words and their meanings. If I had a beat called Meat in the Subway, he'd spell it Meat in the Subway like the food. And it, he just had a really unique way of doing things. It was just charming all the way around, you know? It was a real honor to be able to make even one record with him, never mind, you know, a couple albums worth.
That had to be an amazing feeling, though, to go from, I'll do some stuff to, like, it felt like he was to be part of Super What, the latest release that we have, and to be a part of it, you know, where you're not looking at him as your equal, because I know you wouldn't do that, but somebody where it's like, we're now beyond. I mean, I know I had that moment, at least for me, with some of the ESPN stuff for years, where my buddies would be texting me being like, you're on a show, you're on SportsCenter right now with this guy that we watched in college, and you're telling him like about something. Like, does that ever blow your mind? And you go, you know, look, eventually you get numb, you walk out of the tunnel, you go on, you wave and whatever. But there still had to be moments where you go, this guy's like excited to come on a Czarface album. Like, he's excited to be a part of this. And the whole mask concept, where, I mean, not his mask, but the album concept where he was the guy. That was the whole battle, Czarface versus Doom. That had to be an incredible moment for you, realizing like, I'm doing real stuff now.
It is, you know, and I feel like part of, for better or worse, I always focus on what's next, what's next. And I think I don't let myself sit back and reflect on that. Of course, it hits me, but I'm always thinking, and I'm always thinking about what we can do next. And with this Super What, it's much different, since it came out, you know, after he had passed. And it's just a record that will always feel different, hit different to me because of the nature of it. And it was all recorded long before he passed, and but it came out, you know, after, and it just holds a special place.
That, in a weird way, is kind of the perfect Doom final chapter. I mean, he died in October of 2020.
Yeah.
And what, it had been months before anybody knew? I mean, did you know? Because the public didn't know.
Yeah, only a real small circle of people knew. I did not know. I learned it that day. And I, you know, I dropped my phone. I was like, what? No way. And, you know, I think anyone that follows Doom in his career, and you would think, the first thing you think is, if there's one guy that could pull this off, pull off some type of a hoax or something like that, because you didn't want to believe it, you know? And it was true. And it was very hard to accept for a while. And, you know, I spoke to his wife and gave my condolences and so forth. And his music will last forever. And as you said, there will never be another guy like that. I mean, his mask was inspired by Dr. Doom, right? But through the years, to be more wearable, it became the mask from Russell Crowe, the Gladiator. So that mask was fashioned after the Gladiator mask. And think about the Gladiator and how much money went into that movie and that production. Doom made that mask more famous than that movie ever could. You see that mask and you think Doom. You don't think Gladiator. I know. You know, it's an iconic mask.
Yeah, my brother and I were like, did you see that there's a website? We bought some hoodies and they were like, they have masks for sale. And I was like, yeah, it's amazing. But like, what are we going to do? Wear them? There's a. I was like, are you telling me you want me to get you one? Because I was like, they're pretty cool, but I, you know, I don't.
What am I going to do? You know, yeah. Maybe on Halloween, you know?
And, yeah.
I see a lot of things on Instagram. People tag me in with them wearing the mask and celebrating Doom in a sense. And I think that's great. Kids dressing up as him for Halloween is just amazing. You know, my son, he's 12 and he knows that we work with this MF Doom guy, and it's very interesting to him because he has the mask and it's almost like he's not a real person, you know, and it just puts him on a level. As if the talent wasn't enough, the imagery really, you know, seals the deal. And through all the years of us working in the scene of indie hip hop, underground hip hop, it just, after all the years, we kind of came together and was able to work on things. And of course, he's always will be on a different level. So we're very fortunate. It's kind of like when, you know, KG and Ray Allen got together after all these years playing in the league. They form a team, and win the chip with Paul.
I know. I felt like I probably should have, because you came out with this Tommy Heinsohn tribute video that was incredible that you sent to me. And I was like, oh, do you want me to get this out there? And you were like, no, I just know that you worked with him and you know, you just wanted to see it. So then I was like, as I was prepping for this, I was like, oh shit, does he think I'm going to ask about Evan Fournier? And I was like, no, I want to focus on Doom a little bit more on this pod.
I just want to backtrack. I'm not comparing myself to Paul Pierce or Ray Allen or anything like that. I was more like the James Posey in the situation, but of that team, or maybe an Eddie House. All right.
I didn't take it that way, but you have an out in case anybody does.
Yes. But I think
Leon Paul. I love Leon Paul.
Me too.
I love what you guys are doing. What's next for you? I imagine trying to put together some idea, getting back out on the road. You guys are incredibly prolific with the releases. So,
Yeah. We're working on a couple different releases. We have something really cool coming up that I can't talk about, unfortunately, but I'm frothing at the mouth to talk about it. So eventually, I'll spread the news about that. But there's a lot of cool things in the works. We're doing a lot of merchandising, a lot of stuff with Arvin Goods. Arvin Goods is a sustainable sock company that does the Zarface sock. And I think a lot of the things that you can't download are a big source of income for us. You can't stream an action figure. You can't stream a hoodie. So you go to Zarface.com, you can buy things that you can actually hold and tangible. And you have to give us money for that stuff. So.
Look, the gear is fun. The Arvin stuff's great. Your guy hooked me up a couple years ago. And then, I have a sleeveless. I made some modifications in one of the Zarface tees. And people kind of like, what is that? What are you doing there? And then I gave the socks to my brother. And he thinks they're cool as hell. So
I'll definitely send you more. He'll be very, he's a faithful listener of the show.
All right. Well, it's at Zarface_SO. And that's CZAR for all the people that are going to have a hard time. So just go CZ and then it's going to come right up in Spotify or Apple and check these guys out. Because if you haven't heard them, I'm telling you, if you appreciate any of the stuff that we were referencing there, you're going to enjoy them. So thanks, man. And hopefully I'll get to see you out there again soon. All right.
Oh, I can't wait, man. Thank you so much for having me on.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com. Tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
You want details? Bye. I drive a Ferrari 355 Cabriolet. What's up? I have a ridiculous house in the South Fork. I have every toy you can possibly imagine. And best of all, kids, I am liquid. So now you know what's possible. Let me tell you what's required.
Lifeadvice.rr@gmail.com. Let's see. What do we got here? Feel like, all right, we'll do this one. The cushion incident. Need your help settling a dispute with my wife about what we're now calling the cushion incident. Last week, we had a few friends over for some drinks and dinner, six people, not including us. So we're talking eight folks, keeping up with the math. It was a great night. Everyone had fun. That was that, or so we thought. The next morning, I noticed a small red stain on the carpet in our living room, right beneath one of our cushioned chairs. Upon investigation, I uncovered a huge wet red stain on the cushion of our light colored chair. The wine had soaked through the chair and onto the carpet. All right. So we're talking like, imagine an elevator of stain on cushion level going all the way to carpet level. So that's like, that's a heavy pour on that chair. Okay. So many thoughts immediately ran through my mind. Let me summarize some facts. This is like Knives Out, the movie. None of our guests were ever alone in the room. There were two brief times where either my wife or I were in the living room. During those few minutes, there were at least four or five people in the room at all times. All right, so there's never a solo moment for anyone at the party. Our friend, I'm going to have to change the name just in case. Our friend Veronica was sitting in the chair most of the evening, but her husband, Philippe, also sat there at times. All right, so Veronica and Philippe went, occupied the chair a combined 100% of the time based on the evidence we have here. We were all drinking red wine, so you can't be like, oh, slow gin fizz guy at it again. I'm pretty confident Veronica spilled the wine, but that doesn't bother me as much as the six-person conspiracy to cover it up. Did they not think we'd notice? Did nobody think to grab a napkin before they all decided, yeah, let's flip the soaking wet cushion and pretend it didn't happen? We could have saved the carpet, Ryan. I've asked all of our friends about it, but everyone says they didn't see anything or acts fake surprised about the whole thing. I like that our guy knows that it's fake surprised. Add that to our notes, Kyle. My wife is starting to doubt the stain happened on that night or somehow it happened without anyone noticing. She wants us to just forget about it, eat the cost, and move on. Nope, I'm not having this shit, Ryan. All of these motherfuckers spilled some wine. Or excuse me, one of these motherfuckers spilled some wine. I need closure. So my plan is to invite the same group over for another party, flipping the cushion back over so the stain is on full display. All right, so there's a cushion on the chair. He's going to put that stain side up, and then we'll see what happens. I figure if I get everyone in a room and address it together, somebody is going to crack. My wife is very against this plan. She thinks it'll be super awkward, yes, and needlessly confrontational. Perhaps. I disagree. I just don't see how we can brush this under the rug. I didn't even think he meant to be funny there, without at least confronting our friends about lying to our faces and ruining our stuff. True friends wouldn't act this way. Should I let this go? What would you do in my shoes? All right. Lot to deal with here. Okay. So I want to just double check one of our cushioned chairs. Because the first time I read that, I thought, like, I have some of those chairs that are cushioned, but they're upholstered. So, and then I have slips over them. Yeah, I got to make sure. If you're a solo guy like me and you're always at one chair, rotate the chairs, folks. Just keep them rotate. When it's just you all the time, you have to learn to rotate your chairs and also your couch cushions. Keep those in rotation, because I didn't do that. And after 5 years, I had two brand new sides of the sectional and the chase. And then there was one part where you would have thought somebody slept on it outside for a decade. All right. And I had to get it custom made, and that sucked. Don't know why I shared any of that. I like where your head's at here, but there's one thing that you have to handle first. If you're going to do this version of Clue at your house with the same group, where it's not about the party, it's a complete setup to get to the truth here, which is weird. Your wife is right about that part, but I'm not against it. You have to be 100% certain that it happened that night. And this email doesn't get me to 100%. There's a little doubt here. I have a little doubt because the quote here, my wife is starting to doubt that the stain happened on that night or somehow it happened without anyone noticing. All right. You seem to be 100% certain. She's not 100% certain. So we don't add up to 100% average uncertainty here. Because if you do this and it didn't happen at that night with the same six people that you invite back and you turn into a psycho, that's going to be irreparable for you, my man. This crew is never going to look at you the same way. Because if they actually didn't do it and this whole setup is to get to the truth and they're actually innocent and you don't seem to believe that, then you're going to deal with some serious damage post this investigation. Now, if you're going to do this, I would start here. I would not have the cushion on display initially. I would start with drinks. Maybe pick the pace up a little bit earlier than you normally would for a pre-dinner setup. Get drinks in people. Then, during the kind of kitchen island area that I'm imagining in your open floor concept, you then flip the cushion and then have all the chairs out as you say, hey, the small plates are being served. So now it's out there. Because if you go right to the cushion reveal, It's too early. People aren't going to be as pliable on some of their commentary because they haven't had any drinks. So I would get drinks in them. I would flip the cushion in a moment away from everyone, have the chairs out, and then you have to read six faces at once, specifically the face of the person that has the dirty cushion. And you're going to have to be like a poker player at the table. And then if you don't get a read that you want, you may have to let it go. I would let them initiate it. You know, I would let them expose themselves. But if no one exposes themselves in this moment, then I think you have to just look at your wife and know you're pulling the plug on the plan. Because this is like a Costanza deal. If you set this all up and you start right from the jump accusing people and nobody's had any drinks, and what if they're incident, then a lot of these people aren't going to like you. And they're going to talk about you, man, for years. They're going to say, remember when fill in the blank here invited us all over for a second dinner to try to get to the bottom of his stupid fucking cushion being stained? And it sucks about the carpet. I get that part sucks. You know, but what would you do here, Kyle? Not have a carpet?
I mean, no, I'm a carpet guy now, but I think this is kind of fun in a weird way and an infuriating way. But my question is, if people are eating dinner, how do you spill on the cushion if you're sitting on it? Like, wouldn't a person be basically covered in wine at that point? Or would it be another time where maybe not everyone was sitting in chairs and somebody like knocked it over the table? Because if people are eating dinner, sitting down, how do you get out of there unscathed and then just, you know, hide this wine thing? Like, wouldn't it be all over you as well, unless you're like standing pouring wine or something? It's just like, it doesn't seem like, did you have any of your shithead buddies over that maybe nobody was sitting in that chair and there was like, you were using the table as like a bar or something? I don't know. It just doesn't seem like you'd be able to, like, if everyone's at a table, it just doesn't seem like the forensics of it adds up.
Yeah, I would. It's fair. All this is fair. But would you agree that you've had moments drinking where something happened that defied physics?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, right? Like, it could have been some weird, you know, grabbing something from the salad tongs and then the person hits the glass and it like lands perfectly in between, you know, some skinny jeans. And
then you get up at the same time. It just seems like it would have to be perfect. Right. So I don't know.
Yeah,
I would just ask yourself, did you have any of your buddies over or something at a different time for like a Sunday game or something? I don't know.
Yeah. I, when he says he called everyone to ask about it, because I don't think it's the cost here. I don't think I'm not getting a sense here that the guy's super mad about having to replace the carpet. He's mad that he may have been lied
Clearly
to.
Clearly a principal thing. Yeah.
All right. Because there's also another part of this. This is going to be the only one we do here. But what if they all don't like you and they don't care they stained your fucking carpet?
Then do the intervention. What's a friendship bomb or more detrimental? You falsely accusing them of doing this, or them just straight up lying to your face and not telling you about it? Because they're both shitty moves, but one or the other has to kind of be true, unless the wife is lying, clearly thinks that it didn't happen. Well, I'm just saying, this guy clearly thinks that it happened that night, and the wife is having some doubts. So there is, you know, she could potentially be a suspect if we're talking real Knives Out here. You never know. But it's either they lied to you and they're shitty friends, or you're falsely accusing them and you're the shitty friend. There's no win here.
You know what else we need to discuss too? And this sucks, but because everybody's going to know exactly what I'm talking about here. Would you guys both agree that there are different levels of friends where there's a friend you'd be like, I'm not saying anything. And then there's a friend that you go, I have to say something.
Yes.
And it doesn't even apply necessarily even to a carpet here.
Yep.
There are guys that, you know, you've done something where you may have like, I'll just call myself out here. I remember one time we were staying with some guys, and I don't need to give you more details than that. But your boy ripped out a towel rod of a bathroom, and it wasn't like a plan. It just happened. And my buddy opened the door because he was waiting to use the bathroom. And he was like, what the fuck? I go, dude,
my bad. Like, you know, I reached out and, you know, we get some sheetrock hanging out on the floor. And you just knew in that moment, it was like, I'm not going to say anything because there's somebody else that could be blamed. And it wasn't even that I just knew that it was going to, this person was going to already have like somebody over there with an estimate and he was going to want me to tape it. And, you know, it was just going to be a huge, huge hassle. It was going to ruin like the rest of the day. I regret it now. I would never do anything like that now. But there's a different level of friend where I immediately would have walked out with the towel rod and gone, hey, my bad. This came out of the wall. I'm a big dumb animal. And
was this college?
It's 2 years. I think it's a couple years after college. I think it was two. We're still talking the 90s here. So, I mean.
Because there's a grace period there where I think when you're young, where you're just, it's expected that you have broken shit in your house.
Yeah.
You know, if you have some if you have some like exposed brick or like an exposed beam or something or whatever that's in the wall and some sheetrock that's broken, that's just kind of accepted when you're younger. But if you're probably above 30, you have to tell the person.
Yeah. If you're over 30 doing this kind of stuff, I think that's a good cutoff line. I mean, look, I don't even like, there was a time where I had a guy after a late night, he came back to my place and he was on the couch passed out, and I went up to use the bathroom the next morning and I was like, oh man, he was banged up. And then I went into my bathroom. There's only one bathroom and the entire curtain rod, curtain, everything just destroyed. I don't know what the hell he did, but he probably got up to go into a bathroom that he wasn't familiar with, didn't navigate it well, and just destroyed my curtain. The whole setup like sucked, you know, ripped out from, not just the curtain ripped out of the rod. It was a circular rod around some old antique. I mean, it was an old, old apartment. But I also had a roommate that he didn't know. And I was going to have to deal with my roommate. And the weird thing is, like, if you did it to me back then, I'd be like, ah, whatever, I'll figure it out. Or I'll fix it, not as well as I should. But I knew this was a problem. So I was like, hey, dude. I'm like, you destroyed my shower. He's like, no, I didn't. I was like, look, I'm going to tell you right now. There are two of us. And I know it wasn't. You know, it's like somebody farting in a cab where you're like, all right, I know who did it no matter what. And he was like, no, I didn't do it. And I was like, you definitely did it. I go, you know what? I'm not going to argue with you right now. You probably don't need the argument. But there are just people that handle it differently. There's also people when you're really young where you can be like, hey, I have a dumpy apartment. You have a dumpy apartment. So you think your dumpy apartment, like you don't really care if something happens. But the other person may be like, no, this is my home. This is where I live. And you're not going to disrespect it. And you're like, hey, I live in the same awful complex you do. So why are you acting like, you know, Home and Gardens is coming over here for a photo shoot in a little while? It's not happening. So back to our guy on this deal. I like the plan. I like the whole deal. And we've probably planted way too many doubts about the email itself makes me think that this guy's probably well liked by the group. You had six couples come over to hang out with you and your wife. So it sounds like everybody kind of gets along here. But if you're going to go through this whole plan, like we said, you have to be 100% on this, because if there's a chance it didn't happen then and you just didn't realize it and none of these people are guilty, it could be a real game changer for you. There you go. Life advice, rr@gmail.com. We will be back Sunday, Bill and I, even with the holiday. We're not going to miss any pods, so don't worry about it. We'll be good to go. All right. Talk to you guys soon. Thank you.